Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Financial Times Big Read, a weekly podcast featuring the best of our long-form journalism from around the world. I'm Madison Derbyshire from the Comment and Analysis Desk. This week is the finale of our Europopulism series. We are joined by Big Read editor Jeff Dyer, Paris bureau chief Anne-Sylvain Chassigny, and Berlin bureau chief Guy Chazan to talk about their latest story about European leaders who are struggling to control rising tides of populism in their countries.
Throughout the course of the year, the FT has done a series on what we call the Europopulists. And the idea was to look after the Brexit referendum last year and the election of Donald Trump as the US president, to look at the possible impact of the far right in Europe and the influence it's going to have in politics in the region. And during the course of the year, we've paid a special focus, obviously, to France and Germany, because not only are they the two most important countries in Europe, but because they had major elections this year. The piece we've done this week looks at how the far right didn't actually win any of those elections, but looking at whether that's a false consolation or not. And our two correspondents, Anne-Sylvain Chassigny, the Paris bureau chief, and Guy Chazan, the Berlin bureau chief, are on the line to talk about it. Now, during the course of this piece, you went to two different places in France and Germany. Anne-Sylvain, maybe you can tell us first about where you went to, why you chose Marseille as a way to report on the possible impact of the far right and what you found out when you went there.
Well, I decided to go to Marseille because there was an interesting dynamic down there. The far right National Front had recorded electoral gains over the years, especially since 2014. There were municipal elections, and one of the local National Front politicians there, Stéphane Ravier, managed to get a big chunk of the city. The city is split in different districts, and he managed to get the northern district, which is the densely populated, rather poor, with a mix of old villages, pretty wealthy villages, old villages, and estates, immigrant estates. And I thought it was really interesting to go back because he tried, after this victory in 2014, which was a dozen victories for the National Front that year. He didn't manage to get a seat in Parliament in June, right after Emmanuel Macron's election, despite having a really, really good chances to get the seat this time, because the outgoing socialist MP had been convicted of embezzlement, and the last time around he'd come very close to defeating her. But in this case, an En Marche political novice emerged and won the seat in the wake of Emmanuel Macron's election. So it was really interesting to see why that happened and whether this unusual election of Emmanuel Macron and the subsequent legislative victory, what it meant really on the ground, and if things were changing in Marseille.
How did the Macron candidate defeat the National Front candidate? What were the messages she used to win?
Well, she was one of the activists, one of the En Marche, young activists in Marseille, helping with the campaign during the presidential campaign, and she literally submitted her candidacy to get the endorsement of En Marche literally hours before the deadline. So no one knew her. She literally campaigned on Emmanuel Macron. She just said, give Emmanuel Macron a chance. He's this new guy, young. He wants to disrupt French politics, and I'm going to be helping him in Parliament. And it was really striking to see that even now, people, Marseille residents, don't really know her. So she really won because of Emmanuel Macron mostly.
Now, Guy, you did some reporting from Saxony in East Germany. Tell us why you chose that as the place to chart the rise of the far right in Germany.
Well, Saxony was the site of a political earthquake in Germany in September, the September the 24th Bundestag elections. The AfD, the Alternative for Germany, won in Saxony. They won 27% of the vote and beat Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union into second place. Now, that was an absolutely extraordinary result because the CDU, Merkel's party, has ruled Saxony basically since German reunification in 1990. They rule that state almost like it's their feudal territory. They have a total lockhold on power there. And so it was just absolutely mind-blowing that the AfD should win there. They also won a handful of direct mandates, so direct constituency seats as well, which was also pretty extraordinary. So it was almost like a revolution in Saxony. So I wanted to go to see why it had happened. And it's an extraordinary situation there. I mean, the AfD, what was really funny was that some of the MPs who were elected in these constituencies were total unknowns. One man, for example, was a house painter, and he beat the CDU politician who was a very experienced guy who'd been in the Bundestag for many, many years. So it was almost like people really didn't even care who they were voting for. They just wanted to register their protest.
And tell us a bit about the politics of Saxony, because we do read occasionally about how eastern part of Germany is a bit poor, a bit more behind. You know, there are a sense of, you know, being neglected there, but that's not necessarily the case in Saxony, is it?
No, Saxony is actually a real success story. They call it Silicon Saxony because it's had so much investment into its local industry, and you know, they're building electric vehicles there, and you know, cities like Leipzig and Dresden are really booming. But people still feel very, very disgruntled there. It's there are several reasons for that. The towns are doing well, but the rural population, the rural areas are not. The local infrastructure is very poor. People have been complaining about it for ages. I mean, basically what's happened in East Germany is that so many young people have left the East to go to the West of Germany, where all the great job opportunities are. And there's been a kind of hollowing out of the rural areas, and they've become very depopulated. And as they become depopulated, the local governments just start withdrawing services because it doesn't make sense to have lots of bus lines and lots of GP surgeries and so on operating in such depopulated areas. And the people that are left behind feel very, very disgruntled and angry that all this is happening. And they feel like they've lost control over their destinies. And I think that is one of the main reasons why they voted AfD. It's an argument that you hear repeatedly in Saxony. The other reason is refugees. Now, that is another peculiar thing, because Saxony actually has an extremely white, extremely homogeneous, extremely German population. And so I kept asking people, why did people vote for the AfD, which is an anti-immigration party, when you have so few refugees? And they said, well, we want it to stay like that. We want Saxony to remain white, essentially, and German, which is what they were saying. They don't really care if that sounds racist. They look at West Germany, they see big cities like Cologne, Dusseldorf, Duisburg, which have very big ethnic minority populations, and they see those cities in very, very negative terms. They talk about parallel societies, they talk about no-go areas for the police. That's a bit of an exaggeration. I mean, actually, you know, German cities aren't really like that, but that's their very negative view of them. And they say, we don't want Saxony to become like that. We don't want the rest of East Germany to become like that. So this is one of the other reasons why they voted AfD. It's very interesting. It's Anne-Sylvain mentioned this also in the piece. Quoting an analyst who said that one of the reasons why people are voting for these populist parties, we all think it's because they're the left behind and they're people who have suffered from globalization and European integration and so on. But that's not entirely true. They're voting as well for these parties for cultural reasons, for reasons of cultural identity. And this is something that the AfD has been extremely good at. They've harnessed this fear in the German psyche about a loss of national identity. And they've used it to great success. I mean, they got 13% in the Bundestag election, which is an extraordinary result.
And so then taking us back to northern Marseille, 6 months after the election, Macron's candidate won surprisingly. But what is the mood now? Does he still have a lot of support there, or have things cooled down? Is there a bit more scepticism about him and his candidate in the area?
His victory was in many ways exceptional and also very fragile. I mean, as Alexandra Louise's victory in Marseille, shows, no one really knew her. People voted for her because she was a new alternative, and there was also a coalition of mainstream voters from the right and the left who decided to vote for her. So she managed to really rally the center ground behind her. But the National Front hasn't vanished, and his ideas in northern Marseille haven't either. And it was really interesting attending some of the meetings she had during one day. And she was sat down with residents, constituents, local residents, clubs, and so on. And after that, I've talked to them, and you can sense that they are worried about the impact of immigration. There's widespread concern about how some of the estates do not integrate, how some of the second and third generation of immigrants are just not integrate very well, and there are a lot of drug dealing in Marseille, and some of the estates very difficult areas. Even the police are reluctant to intervene in some of these estates. Alexandra had we even mentioned the fact that there were no-go, lawless. She admitted that some of the zones were very, very tricky. So there's security, anxiety over French identity, the impact of immigration. There are still, major concerns in Marseille, which is a huge town of about 1 million inhabitants, and which is basically a mosaic of, it's like a big puzzle of different, neighborhoods, wealthy even, and estates, then an old village, I mean, we'll see in 2 years' time when there's other new elections, and I think in France the big test will be the EU elections in 2019. We'll see, exactly where we are in terms of far-right ideas. And we can also see in France that the mainstream right, the former the Republican Party, which was defeated during the presidential election and the legislative elections in June, we can see in France that they're shifting to the right. Their new leader, Laurent Wauquiez, is almost, is embracing the far-right ideas on immigration. He's been campaigning on immigration to win the leadership of the party last week. So that's going to be a big test in 2019.
So if I can ask you both to stand back for a second, we've had a year where the far right didn't win the elections in either country, but did historically well in both countries. So what do you imagine the impact is going to be on politics going forward? Guy, maybe you can start. Anselm was talking about how the more centre-right in France is already adopting a lot of the more anti-immigration rhetoric and some policies. Are you seeing that a lot in the centre-right in Germany, and is that going to be how this plays out in the medium term?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, Angela Merkel's CDU is definitely tacking a little bit to the right on the refugee issue. I mean, actually, it's been a very, very long drip process from the sort of peak of her kind of refugees welcome policy of 2015-16. The government has gradually tightened its asylum policies, and actually it's much harder now for refugees to come into Germany. And the CDU recently struck a deal with its sister party in Bavaria, the CSU, which really toughened things up quite substantially, basically saying that there was going to be only a 200,000 refugees would be allowed into Germany every year, except in humanitarian emergencies. And there was a raft of measures actually which they agreed, which they're going to be very keen to push through in any coalition government they form. Probably at this stage, it looks likely it's going to be with the Social Democrats. So yes, you can definitely see an influence. It's also likely that the AfD being in parliament, they've got about 92 seats there, and their voice combined with the Free Democrats, which is a sort of liberal party, which also did well in the September election. It's a liberal party, but it's actually a little bit Eurosceptic as well. That the AfD and the FDP could push the government to be a little bit more sort of Eurosceptic, maybe isn't the word, but a little bit cooler on further moves to towards European integration. Merkel is a very pro-European politician, as is Martin Schulz of the Social Democrats. But that's a very sizable chunk of the Bundestag is now going to be quite Eurosceptic. So they're going to have to keep an eye on that. And that might pull them a little bit further to the right on Europe. So you're going to see the effect of this infiltration of politics by the populist right in many different ways in Germany and in Europe more widely.
And Sylvain, maybe you can pick that up. You mentioned already how the centre-right is tacking to the right on immigration, but what are the other impact going to be? And pick up Guy's theme about how the far-right in Germany might make it harder to have a more pro-European integration platform. That's obviously one of the main themes of Emmanuel Macron. Is the rise of the National Front going to make it harder for him to push that?
I mean, in the short term, he's got Emmanuel Macron has a large majority in parliament, and he has pretty large executive powers. So, on the short term, he can do basically whatever he wants. His strategy on this issue of identity and immigration and refugee has been to literally. Not avoid them, but really talk. I mean, not really addressing them. And he hasn't really addressed them so far. I think the strategy is that, the more you talk about it, and I think there's a nice quote from Kaz Mudurhunak, this professor at University of Georgia, who says, the more you talk about immigration and Islam, the more they become problematic issues. And Michael, and I think that's right. That's accurate. In France, it's been the case that the more you talked about it, the more it became, the more it helped the National Front in many ways. So Emmanuel Macron is basically avoiding these issues, but it's he's betting basically that his economic reforms are going to be enough to reassure those voters, who are anxious about their, identity and French culture and immigration. I'm not sure that's going to be, enough personally, because we've seen that these, pressures, populist pressures are, happening in countries where those reforms that he's carrying out have been implemented already. So I think in France it's not going to have impact in short-term impacts, but I think as Guy was saying, I think it will have a broader impact on Europe and on, because the mere the principle of solidarity has been hurt during the refugee crisis. Europe has tried to come up with a mechanism to share, the influx of refugees, across Europe, and it has, hasn't really been welcome, across Europe, and it's the mechanism has just been ditched by the Commission last week. So it will have, I think, some impact on other areas of EU integration, including economic integration, fiscal transfers. If Europe cannot agree on how to solve the refugee crisis, will it, agree on fiscal transfers and economic solidarity? It's a big concern.
And Sylvain, at the time of the presidential election, though, you did hear a lot of people saying that Macron is essentially the last chance for the establishment, and that if his government fails in the way that the Hollande government was perceived to fail, then the National Front really will have a very good chance next time round. Is that the right way to think about the Macron government? Are they the last hope for the French centre ground?
I mean, he's positioning himself as the bulwark against populists in France. So in many ways, he's making that point. But it's probably, we'll see, the centre-right, at the moment the problem is that he has no proper opposition, mainstream opposition, on the right and on the left. It's a bit too early to say whether, the Republican or the Socialist Party will be able to rebuild, regroup and become something more significant in the next few years. The National Front is not in a great state, even though his ideas that he's been defending and or not haven't vanished. The party itself has been weakened by by Marine Le Pen's defeat in the presidential election. So yes, Macron is probably the last chance of the mainstream politician in France, but on the other hand, the political landscape is a desert around him. So he's also got an opportunity to make it right.
And Guy, last question for you. All this is happening at a time where Angela Merkel, her party, came out as the biggest winner, the biggest party in the elections, but she is looking beleaguered in many ways. She's failed in her first attempt to put together a coalition government. Is this the beginning of the end for Angela Merkel? And if so, what will that mean for the space for populist far-right parties in Germany if she was to disappear from the scene?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, I was speaking to an analyst yesterday who said basically the zenith of Merkel's power, both in Germany and in Europe, was around 2015, before the refugee crisis. It's definitely the case that the refugee crisis really undermined her authority, both in Germany and elsewhere. I mean, conservatives in her party, the CDU, won't forgive her for the fact that she pushed the party so far to the centre that she left this gaping vacuum on the right, which has now been occupied by the AfD. They're absolutely horrified that a sort of far-right party has been able to enter the Bundestag, the first one to do so in more than 50 years, and they blame Ms. Merkel for that. Yes, so you definitely have a sense that Angela Merkel's sort of authority in her own party and in Germany itself has been undermined, and by extension, her authority in Europe. And this comes at a time where the Europeans are very eager to get a German response to Emmanuel Macron's reform proposals. So far, we haven't had one. So there is a sort of feeling of political paralysis at the moment in Germany, which doesn't do the country's image abroad any good. And that is definitely grist to the mill of the populist parties such as the AfD, because they've been banging on for months, if not years now, about how the established parties are basically incompetent and ineffective, and that the establishment is bankrupt morally and politically, and that they want to shake things up. And in a way, the kind of paralysis that we're seeing is in many ways a kind of a vindication of the arguments that they've been deploying over the past few months.
Alfred, that's all we've got time for today. So I just say thank you to Anne-Sylvain Chassagny in Paris and Guy Chazan in Berlin. And thank you for listening.